way the system works. And so if we change the institutions effectively, we change the incentive system, and hopefully we change it in directions that makes it more effective. Now I have one more background piece before I get to telling the main part of my story, and that is violence. Humans are like chimpanzees. Not completely, you understand, but one of the things that distinguishes chimpanzees from other primates is that they're violent with each other. They kill each other. Now, a lot of primates like bonobos and so on are much more tolerant and gentle with each other. Human beings are violent. And one of the things you've got to understand if you're going to understand how societies work is that the kind of ways that human beings have structured themselves to try to make the society work means you've got to limit violence amongst the participants. You've got to constrain the players so in their own interests they will cooperate and do things that will make the system work. Now with this background, I want to argue that there's just three social orders in all of human history. And by social order, I mean three ways that human beings have structured the game to try to get the society to produce economic, political, and social activity. The first is a primitive social order, and I'm not going to talk about that. That's hunting and gathering societies, and it's of historical interest. And in the book that I'm writing with my colleagues, we do devote some attention to it. But the next two social orders are ones that are of real relevance to the world we live in today. The second is what John called the natural state, or limited access societies. And limited access societies began with the development of agriculture in 8000 BC in Mesopotamia, and still characterize more than three quarters of the world's population today. What's made the natural state so natural is that when you put people together and in the face of the continual threat of violence, they tend to form a structure that is remarkably similar in its basic framework all over again. That is, what you will get was a group of elites and political, economic, social organizations that will run it. They'll be a small percentage of the population, maybe 10, 15, 20% at the most. Those elites will find it in their interest to cooperate with each other in order to prevent violence from occurring. And they'll cooperate in ways that ensures that they jointly support each other's rents, that is, income that derived from various kinds of activity. To give you an illustration, economic elites will support political elites in return for the political elite limiting the competition that economic elite faces. In other words, giving them monopoly returns. And if you think that's unusual, I can assure you, if you look around the world at natural states, that's standard. It exists everywhere. But it's not just economic elites. The same holds true for religious, social, political. All elites stand to gain by cooperating with each other and protecting each other's rents in an interdependent structure. In return for that, they get some stability, a modest amount of economic growth, and indeed preserve a way that maintains their privileges. Notice that in the world I'm describing, it has several crucial features, one of which is that only about maybe 15 to 20% of the population are parts of the elites and enjoy all the privileges. The rest of the population are, well, at best, second-class citizens. That is, whether they're serfs or slaves or simply not part of the elites, they don't enjoy the same privileges, the same rights that the elites do. The second feature about the natural state that's important is that it is a world of personal exchange. It's a world in which the way to deal with other people is who you know. Now, I want to emphasize this because personal exchange is a key feature of limited access societies. It's a key feature of the way in which humans deal with each other. When I'm an advisor to countries that are natural states, and I'm advisor to quite a number of them, I always ask, I don't find out what the rules of the game are. I find out who really determines what the rules are. And that's the person you want to go and talk to and see, because that determines really what happens in the system. Now, I'm going to come back to the limited access or natural state, but I want to talk about the third social order. The first was a primitive one, the second, limited access. The third is an open access society. It occupies no more than 15 to 20% of the world's population today. And it has emerged in the last 300 years at most. Its key feature is competition in both political and economic markets. And indeed, competition that makes it so that the rents that I observed in a limited access society tend to be temporary and eliminated over time, because if you have rents that are making for very high rates of return, whether political, economic, or social, it'll be in the interest in a world of competition for groups to come in and attempt to do things better in that particular market and replace the existing group. So an open access society is a very dynamic society. Also, it has the feature that it doesn't matter who you are. What matters is that the rules of the game apply to everyone. That is, what you have, instead of personal exchange, you have impersonal exchange. You have property rights that are defined that apply not just to elites, but apply to everybody in the society. And the property rights, therefore, tend to define the way the game is played, and judicial systems play the role of seeing that the rules are enforced between groups in participation and in exchange. So an open access society is just a very different sort of a world. And indeed, the differences are much more than appear on the face, because if you're going to have an open access society, first of all, it requires that most of the people in the society become participants, that is, become equal citizens in the system. And indeed, when you look at the development of open access society, you see that they gradually move from limited property rights over who could vote, to extending property rights to wider groups, to opening, to bringing in minorities, to bringing in women, and so on. This process of expansion, so that the open access society is innately a democratic system in the sense that everybody participates, everybody is equal, and that characterizes the system. Now, at this point, I hope you're saying, well, if it's so desirable, how come all the world isn't open access? And it is desirable in the sense of per capita income. If you look at per capita income of countries around the world, you observe that limited access societies have per capita incomes that typically are below $10,000 per capita. A lot of them way below. Whereas open access societies are those that typically have per capita income between $20,000 and $40,000 per person. The immense gap. It's not just a small gap. And that's because a open access society typically produces such dynamic change that productivity keeps on growing continually. And as a matter of fact, when we do studies of it, what we observe is that open access societies don't necessarily grow more rapidly on a particular year than limited access societies, which do grow, but they grow steadily. Whereas limited access societies tend to have periods of rapid growth when they, say, get some commodity that's in big world demand, and then fall back into recession and depression and chaos at times in this case. How do we get from one to the other? What we call a transition in our book. Well, the transition is one that requires that we transform society. And this is why it turns out to be so complicated, because if you're going to transform a world from one in which there's privilege, unequal opportunity, unequal access to privilege and so on, to one in which everybody, at least on the surface, is nominally equal, and in which everybody has a voice, you're fundamentally making a change that is so fundamental that it changes the way the game is played. There's three doorstep conditions that have characterized the transition. The first doorstep condition is that elite groups, in their own self-interest, and that last phrase is very important, in their own self-interest, will extend property rights to a wider and wider group of the population in the interest of increasing the amount of rents that they get, which is not surprising. You have they can expand economic activity, and if they include more people in it, they get more rents. But once you've done that, what you begin to do, and that is do the second doorstep condition, which in order to do that, you've got to take and create institutions and organizations that are out of the reach of government. So far, in a limited access society, all of the institutions that are created are creatures of government and don't exist without the support of government. But if you're going to get many of the advantages of wider markets, you need to create organizations that can take advantage of new opportunities. If you want to look at the historical part of the story, when you see the Netherlands, England, and France in the 15th, 16th, and 17th century, what they did is observe the opportunities that arose from overseas trade. And to begin with, what the governments did was create monopolies that, like the East India Company or other companies like this, that went about extending overseas trade. But over time, these companies found it to their advantage to be able to have degrees of autonomy that were independent of government control. And eventually what you got was the governments granting them the right to establish themselves independent of this. So what you gradually evolved was institutions and organizations that gradually proliferated to take advantage of the enormous growth and opportunities associated with increasing trade and commerce and so on. So that's step two. Step three is a more complicated one, and I won't deal with it adequately. And that is, in a limited access society, the key to preventing violence is that you have elite groups that one of which is the military itself. And the elite groups cooperate with the military so that they jointly work and solve the problem of providing stability at home and preventing violence from outside. But the heart of an open access society is that the military should become subservient to the civilian population. And if that doesn't exist, then you have what I observe, and I'm an advisor to a lot of countries in Latin America, a classic case of what happens in Latin America. Every time an elite group starts to get into trouble, they call in the military, impose a dictatorship for a while, wipe out all existing structure, and preserve their own privileges. Now, obviously, as long as that can happen, you have a problem. Let me tell you a personal story to illustrate it. I was an advisor to the Argentine economy for many years and became a very good friend of the president of the Argentine economy. Now, Argentina is an interesting story because in 1940, it was the sixth highest income country in the world. and then fell into, with Perron, it fell into disarray and stagnation that lasted until 1980, when the president who came in then appointed a man named Cavallo, who tied the peso to the dollar, and for a period you had a surging growth. Well, I was down there in the middle of the 1980s, and the president, as he did every time I came down, invited me to have lunch. And he said, "Doug," he said, "I'm going to run for re-election." I said, "You can't do that." I said, there's a rule that says that there's a term limit. You can't get re-elected more than twice," which is, he was up for it, had finished his second term. "Oh," he said, "don't worry about that." He said, "I'll change the rules." "Oh," I said, "well, in that case, the courts will stop you and they'll impede you." "Oh," he said, "that's all right, I'll pack the Supreme Court." He did both and got reelected, I might add. What I told him at the time, I was being prescient also, in danger of being thrown out, I said, "as long as you can do that, you're never going to become an open access society. Because as long as you have that kind of rhythm, change the game, the way the game is played, the game is always going to be one which is going to be dominated by political rules that could be altered by that kind of special privilege, and you have not managed to solve the problem of creating an open access society." I was right, he was wrong, and I happily got out of Argentina. Now, I don't want to take any much longer time because I want to get discussion and question from all of you. But let me just make a few final comments that I think are relevant. The process of going from a limited access to an open access society is a process that engenders much more than simply changing some rules. It means you try to change the whole way the society works. You've got to do what John talked about in his introduction. You've got to lower the cost of transacting amongst markets by encouraging the growth of trust and cooperation on a wider audience, and that are complements, in other words, to a rule of law. A rule of law does not work just by imposing a set of rules. You've also got to create informal norms of behavior that are complementary to such rules that make it possible so cooperation can work. Because one of the things about an open access society that's crucial is that they exist by having enormously expanded markets that are interdependent and that operate independent of any government activity, and they require that you have low costs of transacting. And low costs of transacting obviously is not possible unless you extend and develop a degree of cooperative behavior that is a necessary condition as a part of this process. So one of the things that we observe is, in the sequence of movement from a limited access to an open access society, you not only extend citizenship to a wider and wider group of the population, but you also build a much more complex set of informal norms of cooperation that make it possible to break down the barriers of exchange, for people to learn to trust each other in complex markets, and to develop the conditions, therefore, that make this possible. Now, let me conclude with one final comment. It should be, I think, obvious, if I've done my job, I'm not sure I have, it should be obvious why it's so hard to move from a limited access to an open access society. It is because if you try to impose the rules that make an open access society work, competition, equality of opportunity, continual ability of everybody to participate, to be real players in the system, if you have such a world, if you apply that to a limited access society, you're going to destroy the very thing that makes for stability and prevents violence. That is, the structure of interdependence of elite groups in a limited access society provides a structure that is designed to keep rents there and to prevent violence amongst the parties. But if you break down that structure without replacing it with something new then what you get is a world in which disorder and chaos characterize the system. If you want a good illustration, you want to see what's happened to Iraq in the last 10 years. I know we're responsible, we, United States, not me. I had no part of it. But the United States destroyed, it's true, a less than wholesome dictator, but he managed to, he was a classic limited access society. He preserved order, and when you wiped him out, if you didn't replace him with another structure that made for preserving order, what you got is exactly what we have in Iraq today. Chaos and disorder, and moreover, we don't know how to get out of it. I assure you we don't. So we've created a terrible dilemma for ourselves, but it should illustrate for you something that I want to leave you with. And that is, getting stability, getting order, is a necessary precondition to building a framework that can encourage economic growth. It's more complicated process. You've got to evolve competition, cooperative behavior, low cost of transacting that John and I mentioned. All of those are complementary parts of it. But it's that those things together that make possible the kind of economic growth that we're trying to attain. Thank you. John, do you want to come up here and take, or would you, I don't care who arbitrates, or you going to do that? Okay, good. I got to trust you.
Okay.
You call the shots then.
Right. Thank you, Professor North. You can mosey over to this chair over here. You can take the questions from.
Oh, okay. I can sit down now.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you.
All right, wait. We have two mics, one in the center aisle and one at the side near the fire exit. Those who want to ask questions, please raise your hand. And when I call you, please proceed to the nearest microphone, state your name, your college or institutional affiliation, and your question. Yes, please.
Professor North, after reading your book on
America, your name, please state your
name. I am Joe Romero from the University of Asia and the Pacific. I want to, first of all, thank Professor North because his book on American history made me pass my American history exam at Georgetown. Professor North, the Spanish colonizers created the agricultural elite. They were co-opted by the Americans to create a politically entrenched economic elite. When the Americans left, they used the institutions that we're talking about, constitution, political party systems, to just replace each other and to continue the rent-seeking activities that we have to this day. My question is, since the axis is closing instead of opening, we don't even have open skies or open seas. All of the public utilities are owned by the monopolists and oligopolists. How do you break this thing? What? Short of a Chavez or a Musharraf or something like that, or a Perón, what is the formula for this Nirvana open access that we talked about with the use of political or economic institutions? Thank you.
Well, let's see if I can handle it. First of all, I should say something more than I did earlier. And one of the things that's important to understand is that every society is different. I tried to make that point when I talked about the culture of every society being a function of the beliefs and institutions that have evolved in that particular context. And this is important because while there are some generalizations about how each social order works, and if you're going to be specific about it, you've got to know an enormous amount about that particular society. I do not go and give advice to any country without devoting at least 6 months to understanding the beliefs and institutions of that society. And if I don't do that, I refuse to give any advice. And I'm not going to give any advice about the Philippines because I don't. So that what I'd have to know is the specifics. Now, in every case, however, there is some generalizations that apply. One of the generalizations is, if you look at limited access societies, they tend to go in a progression from those that are very fragile, which are always on the edge of violence, and you're always worried about it, and therefore all the institutions are geared to trying to prevent violence, to ones that are getting more stable, get more economic activity, get more structure, and so on. And that process, as it goes on, therefore means that what you want to do, if you're going to improve the performance of a limited access society, is you want to move it along the direction of more stability, more internal order, and more complex institutions that gradually extend the institutions and organizations beyond simply government controls. And I can't say more than that because I'd have to specify what in each particular society. Although, if you ask me about China, where I've done this for a while, I could be more specific, but you don't want to hear all about China. It'll take 6 hours. Yes.
My name is Paul McNeilis from Fordham University. I just wanted to ask about the issue of a country regressing from an open society to a natural state. The transitions could go in reverse. And in particular, I want to ask your view about the United States. We have this underclass of illegal immigrants, and so far, I mean, our political system has been deadlocked of trying to come to some resolution so that we have this underclass that does not have access of citizenship, is unable to participate, unable to have sufficient property rights to ever really enculturate, and another class which is speaking another language. And so, I mean, do you see this as a real sort of a burning inflection point for the United States, this failure to resolve this permanent underclass?
That's a good question and an embarrassing one for an American, I think, because I think that it poses a problem that we have not resolved, that I think is right up the alley of exactly the dilemmas that concern us.